Hello and welcome to Series 4, Episode 10 of Out with Susie Ruffle. Hello, I hope that you're having a good week. As ever, I need to thank all of you that got in touch with me after last week's episode with David Carlisle. I love him. I think that was pretty clear from the conversation. And I had lots of lovely emails as well. If you want to get in touch with me, you always can. Please do. The email is hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. I'm always keen to receive your emails. So if you're one of those people that have been thinking for a while, oh, I really should email in. Do it. Do it. Share your story with us in the last couple of episodes of this series. I would love that. Yeah, there's always lovely messages. The best way to get hold of me is through that email or on Instagram. I try and stay away from Twitter as much as possible because I find it quite toxic. So I've got a couple more tour shows coming up. I'm really excited about that. I'm excited to finish off doing this tour, which started in 2019, which feels like a very long time ago. I think we can all agree. Very excited about writing some new material, doing a new tour, which will probably be happening around this time next year. I've been on the telly a bit lately. If you want to catch up on stuff, I was on an episode of Rod Gilbert's Growing Pains, which you can watch on Now TV. I was also on Between the Covers, which is a show about books, which I absolutely loved being part of. That's hosted by the DJ Sarah Cox, who I absolutely love. Also, the documentary that I was part of, Womanhood, was on a week or so ago and is now on the BBC iPlayer. I think it's really good. It sparked a lot of conversation and some people loved it and some people were quite angry with me for being really inclusive. And that's okay. Those people can be angry with me. Okay, let's get on to today's episode. I'm going to put a trigger warning right at the top. So both in one of the emails that I'm going to share today and in the conversation with the amazing Michael Chakravarty, who is just wonderful, just such a wonderful man, there is talk of depression and suicide. So if today feels like a day where you don't want to listen to that sort of thing, or maybe you never want to listen to that, that's totally fine too. Maybe stop here and come back to us next week and find something else that is more comfortable for you to listen to today. Okay, let's go on with a couple of listener emails and then we'll get to the lovely conversation with the wonderful Michael Chakravarty. Hi, I'm listening to your interview with Rose Schmitz and have found it really resonate, particularly comments about representation and some of the hard things about doing something creative. On the first front, I'm a non-binary, gender-fluid, queer something. I prefer to be ambiguous and not clearly defined. I struggle with the idea of coming out because the question is, as what? And the first time I can think of seeing anyone like me on TV was probably when I watched Feel Good this summer. I'm Canadian and have lived in the UK, so have a lot in common with May, but seeing someone who dresses like me and also occupies a similar non-binary space was kind of a first. I'm also a creative. I was told my entire childhood that creative ambitions would lead straight to joblessness and homelessness. All those things that adults tell kids. And we get told these things because our parents worry about us. Being poor and precariously employed is quite unpleasant and stressful. Basically, my entire life, I was sent messages that the two most important parts of me were bad and that I would be better if I tried things that I'm supposed to be, more feminine and not creative. Luckily, I did find a design path that works for me, and I try to remember how desperately past me wanted to be where I am now. But I also think we tell kids all sorts of ridiculous things about job options and possible futures. There are careers in design and the arts and lots of ways in which other fields are actually really creative. I wish that kids had the chance to just be whatever they wanted to be and to be encouraged in their curiosities and interests. Instead, I was told no to the parts of me that society didn't have space for over and over. Also, you mentioned your desire to take a pottery class despite having been crap at art your whole life. On one hand, there are certain things we can't be. For me, a singer, a dancer, good at maths. But there's also this weird standard around creativity that you have to be amazing or it's not worth it. Until a certain age, every kid draws and does crafts and they don't really care if they're good at it. That's not the point. I encourage you to get back to making stuff just because it's fun. If that's something you want to do with no expectations around what you might produce or how good it might be. I started writing poetry a few years ago and initially it was something I did because I think words are fun. I still do it with no real concern for whether they are crap, though I generally only share stuff that I think others might have a desire to read. If the art is just for you, then making it is what counts. The rest doesn't matter. Cheers, And that's from Ree. Thank you so much for getting in touch, Ree. I think that I'm saying your name correctly. I really hope that I am. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I should just have a go. And do you know what? I think my girlfriend might have got me a pottery class for Christmas. Oh, and I keep saying girlfriend. She's definitely my wife now. But listen, don't tell her. Don't tell her that I think I know that that's what she's got me. Don't tell her. And if my mother-in-law is listening, you also don't tell her. Okay. Thank you for getting in touch, Ree. Let's move on to another listener email. Dear Susie, first off, let me give you my permission to share my name if you end up reading this letter. It is a relief that I'm in a place where I'm ready to share my name and some of my story. I'm finally proud of where I am in my journey to understanding and accepting my sexuality. It's been a long road to get here. And I'm so grateful to you, Glennon Doyle, Jamila Jamil, Florence Given, and the late Bloomers Lesbian subreddit for giving me vocabulary and acceptance I didn't think I'd ever have. Thanks to the brave people like you, I truly believe more happiness will be found as we continue to share our experiences and our strength. I hope my story might help at least one person feel less alone and possibly inspired to share their true self with the world. Forgive me for not totally knowing how to organise my thoughts here, but I am going to try my best. Well into my 20s, I could never understand why I couldn't say I'm straight with ease, or why saying I'm gay was fraught with such panic and fear that I'd gotten it wrong and would need to go back on my word. Only after many years of therapy, hiring a life coach, changing careers, travelling the world, getting a puppy, joining two recovery programs, was I able to get to the core of why I struggled so much to define my sexuality. I actually didn't trust myself to be myself. I struggled to have any sense of self. My sexuality was wrapped up in the chameleon exterior I worked so hard to maintain. I was busy trusting everyone around me to tell me who I was and that I was or wasn't capable of and who I should date. I've come to realise that my sexuality is very closely aligned to me being free of the codependence I hung on to for far too long with my mother. I had witnessed a breakdown when my older brother came out as gay. I was around 13 and my brother popped home from university to tell us he'd realised he was gay. Then he went back away, and I was at home struggling with what sexuality even meant. I remember my first thought when he told me was something along the lines of, oh shit, that's what's wrong with me too. But I stuffed that sentiment down and began pretending. Pretending him being gay didn't mean much to me, and that I was happy for him. And it wasn't that I wasn't happy for him, but I was scared and panicked inside. I remember being concerned that they would be able to test my DNA for gayness. At that point, I didn't have much vocabulary to talk about my own sexual feelings that had just recently begun. And it scared me so much to see my mum cry and express sheer fear that life would be hard for him. There was no way I could add more queerness to the family, though I didn't even know the word queer until much later in life. It's interesting because I think many people would assume that having a gay brother would make my journey to understanding my sexuality easier. Actually, I think it made it harder because the role I assumed in my family. I was the youngest and the only girl, and my parents loved to remind me, even to this day, how happy they were to have a girl. I have some feminine aspects, but some masculine as well. I really struggled with the little straight girl role I was cast to play in my family. I was supposed to make everyone else comfortable and stuff down my own feelings, thoughts, opinions, and dreams. It was exhausting and not sustainable, but more on that later. Anyway, when my brother came out, I didn't have a label for my sexuality. I knew I was not straight, and I was seriously concerned about the erotic dreams I was having about women. I was on the swim team throughout high school, and I wanted to crawl into a hole and disappear every time I had a sex dream about one of my teammates. Seeing my mum fall apart and cope so poorly with my brother's sexuality showed me at a very impressionable age there was absolutely nothing to be celebrated about being anything but straight. That mentally stuck with me for the next 15 years as I tried really hard to be straight. In some ways, I did enjoy sex with men, and I'm still untangling whether or not I was attracted to them or attracted to the idea of being wanted in a normal way. This was where I was so relieved to grant myself some compassion and patience. Thanks to your podcast and other LGBTQIA plus people brave enough to share their stories, I can accept that I'm still learning to acknowledge and cherish all of me, whether I am turned on by a man, woman, or a non-binary person. I'm so thankful to you and the path you're paving to allow your listeners the vocabulary to talk about this very important parts of ourselves. I can't say that I figured it all out or that I'll ever be 100% certain of a particular label, but I'm much nicer to myself than I once was. Trigger warning. I tried to kill myself in my early 20s when I could no longer pretend that I wanted to follow the path laid out for me. I remember being so cruel to myself, criticizing myself for not even being brave enough to throw myself over the railings of a bridge to stop my pain. Even as I write these words 10 years later, I'm overcome with sadness that I truly believe that suicide was the only option to stop my pain. No one deserves to feel that way, but at that point, I certainly didn't have the knowledge, nor did I understand how I'd gotten myself there mentally. I blame no one and nothing but myself. However, I now know that I had slowly learned to hate myself through years of repressing who I am or the life that I'm meant for. Not having any sense of self for so long led me to exist solely for other people, and it's no wonder that I didn't enjoy life. The family I grew up in was very performative, and how we looked held much more importance than how we felt or who we were as individuals. As I grow stronger in my identity and kinder to myself, I am and will continue to be forever grateful to be alive. I'm not sure where my path will go, but I think bright things lie ahead. Thank you for the light you spread. With love and appreciation, your queer friend, Marissa. And that's from the USA. Hi, Marissa, from across the pond. I'm so delighted that you felt that you could share this with me and sharing your sort of sexuality or your feelings with the world, which is such a hard and confusing thing to do, especially, you know, growing up like most of us have in, you know, a really homophobic society, whether that was really obvious to us or whether it was sort of more subconscious. I think, you know, it's always there. And I'm so pleased that you're feeling so much better now and that you're finding a real joy in who you are. And I'm really touched that you feel that the podcast has helped that in some way. And I mean, that's the very reason that I make this show. So thank you for sharing that with me, Marissa. It really means a lot. And I hope that whatever you're doing, you're having a great day. Okay, let's go to the brilliant conversation that I had earlier this week with the wonderful Michael Chakravarty. You might know him from Bake Off. He is just a wonderful guy, and I loved this chat with him. I really hope you do too. I am so excited for today's guest. I love Michael Chakravarty. You might know him from series 10 of The Great British Bake Off, where his warmth, kindness, sense of humour and excellent bread made him a firm audience favourite. Or you might know him as a writer. His work has appeared in The iPaper, The Metro and The Guardian, amongst others. He also hosts an excellent podcast, The Menkind Podcast with Mark Watson, which I highly recommend. I was recently on it, and then I did that terrible thing that people do sometimes, is that when they're on a podcast, they then go and listen back to old episodes of it. And I've listened to loads of it, and it's really bloody brilliant. And if you enjoy Out, then I'm pretty sure you will enjoy Menkind as well. So look that up. It's an absolute joy to have a conversation with him today. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hello. Oh, I finished cringing now. That's good.
I know, you just said to me, I didn't know you did the intro live.
Well, I don't know. I always just assumed it happened elsewhere. It was very nice of you. Thank you.
I mean it all. How are you?
I am well, thank you. We just talked about how I was worried about what I was wearing, and then I realised that it's only me and you that can see each other, so it doesn't really matter.
No, but you are looking lovely.
Thank you. As are you. Lovely jumper. Your jumper actually matches your wall.
Well, my jumper's pink and my wall is red.
Right.
But there is, it's a similar hue.
They're sisters, I think. Definitely sisters.
I'd say they're sisters. Mm. It's very nice to have you on the show. I was such a fan of you on the Bake Off, and then we sort of became Twitter friends and then maybe even real life friends, which was quite exciting.
Well, it was exciting for me because I was a fan of like-minded friends of the original podcast Ilk, right?
The Orig.
And then I've also been a fan of this podcast, long-time listener, first-time participant. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's very nice to have you. You're coming to us from Newcastle today.
Yes, I am a northern boy now, surrounded by the most sexy accent of all, I think, the Geordie accent. Would we agree?
I think it's a sexy accent. Are you big into accents when you're dating someone?
Not really, no, but I just think there's something about an accent, isn't there? There's something, I think it's the Geordie one, the Welsh one, and the Irish. I think basically anything that's just not normal British. I find Glaswegian quite angry, which might put off some listeners, but it just feels quite aggressive. But that's just me being posh Scottish.
It snips on the consonants.
It does. Oh, that's very good analysis.
And so I think it's because it's sort of ba 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 ba.
To be honest though, Susie, I can't really be that picky about accents. Anyone that'll have me, any accent you have, Glaswegian or not.
Because you've got a posh Scottish accent, which
I do.
Very nice.
Yeah, people don't often think I'm Scottish. I was actually born in Newcastle, but brought up in Scotland. So I've got like a bit of a lilt. I think it's more that I just say Scottish words in a neutral accent. I don't know. I was brought up in Perthshire by one Scottish person and one English person. So it's sort of right. just as it's a middling accent, I think I would say. I don't know. Do you think I sound Scottish?
No, I think that it was only when you said I've got a posh Scottish accent that I was like, oh yeah, that's what it is. So I think it's quite hard to place.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. People often think in England I sound Scottish, in Scottish I sound English. But then when I went on television, it just became... no one knew where I was from.
People were like, is he Welsh?
I wish. Oh, I'd sound much happier if I was. Everyone in Wales just sounds happy with everything they say. They'll be talking about a storm battering the coast and you just think, oh, isn't that nice?
It is a beautiful accent. That yeah, is very true.
Very sing-song.
It's very true. So you mentioned before that you were born in Newcastle, but then you moved up when you were very young to Scotland.
Yeah, so in 2000, so I'd have been 7 years old. So I don't really remember. Well, I was born in Newcastle. We moved to Yorkshire for a bit and I remember the house in Yorkshire, but that's all I really remember from there. And interestingly, actually, whenever I read books, that is the house. Like,
oh, really?
Yeah, that's the house that I picture in every book. I read The Help recently and that's the house. And yeah, all films, all books that I read, whenever there's a house in the book, it's always my house in Yorkshire that I grew up in until I was seven, and then we moved to Scotland. What house do you picture?
I don't know that I do. I don't know that there's a specific house.
But we'll have to talk about it next time you read a book. Just let me know which house you thought of.
I'll just text you, yeah, and be like, oh my God, I'm thinking of your house in Yorkshire as well.
It was a lovely
That's
house.
That's so weird, because I don't know what it looks like, but I'm absolutely certain it's Michael's house.
Yeah, but my memory started in Scotland. I only really remember kind of growing up in Scotland, and I left there in 2016, 2017, and I've lived back in England again because that's where work is.
I wonder if the Yorkshire house thing is because that's like the blueprint in your brain of what a house looks like.
It's weird, isn't it? I think it is to do with that. I think it's to do with the fact your mind is kind of formed in that place, if that makes sense. I think your first experiences of kind of learning where a kitchen is and learning where the living room is and having your own bedroom or sharing a bedroom, all of that happens in that one place. But then I think also your life is also kind of contained within that place when you're that age. Whereas when you kind of get past seven, you go outside a bit more. Well, we went outside, obviously. To be clear, I was allowed out when I was younger. But your life is a bit more contained when you're younger, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And so what was little Michael like? How early were you baking? That's my first question.
I was baking. We baked all the time with my mum at home. Mum and I baked all the time in the kitchen. I shudder to think of the bakes that I made, but I do remember having a Roald Dahl baking book, like based on all the bakes from his things. And there was this porcupine cake that you had to make. I never made it, but I just looked at the pictures and I loved all of that.
Would you put loads of matchmakers in as the spikes? Was that it?
I think what they said was to like make chocolate, like rolled chocolate spikes, which is a bit much when you're like...
That's a lot for a seven-year-old. Yeah. Like, that's really putting a shift in as a seven-year-old baker.
For sure. But my mum's always had this brilliant cookbook, which I have... I've put dibs on for when she dies.
That's nice.
Which is, obviously, I'll be very sad as well. But it's a cookbook that's been passed down through her generations. Like, it's got her great-granny's recipes and her great-granny's handwriting and all these things. And so that has always lived in the kitchen. And it's kind of closed with a rolling pin. It's like a little latchy thing.
Ah.
And so from a Christmas a couple of years ago, Mum photocopied every single recipe and gave it to me. And so I've got a copy myself. And so we kind of always... we've always kind of scribbled out recipes by hand and things like that. So it's always been a part of our lives when we were baking, but my brothers weren't particularly interested. So I just got involved.
That's really nice. And that's so interesting that it's not interesting. Interesting is the wrong word, but that's so beautiful that it's passed down through generations, that it's like, that's something that's sort of almost hereditary to you.
Yeah. And then I felt really guilty when I was on Bake Off because I used some of the recipes. And when you use a recipe on Bake Off, it becomes property of the Bake Off. And I was like, but it's not though, because it's my great granny's. And they were like, yeah, I know, but we own this now. And I was like, oh, right. So I changed them slightly so that the hours are still ours and they've got a slightly different one.
That's nice.
Yeah, for sure.
That's nice, just to keep it. Just to keep it a little bit for yourself. And what was your family setup like? Your mum, dad, and you've got
two brothers. Yeah. So my mum and dad, and then I've got a big brother called Daniel, who's 2 years older, and a little brother called Cameron, who's 2 years younger. And the younger one is the most clever out of all of us, which is frustrating. But there we are. I think he deserves it because when we were younger, we used to like, I feel like when you're younger, I hope you doesn't listen to this. When you're younger, I feel like you view a younger sibling as like expendable. Like if there's
I really hope that Cameron's not listening as well. Cameron, if you are listening, please get in touch and you can have your say like, on this show.
I feel like they, like when you go into like a scary like water slide, you'll send Cameron down first. If he makes it, great. And if he doesn't, then you know to go on the other slide. And that's always been the case. So I feel like he probably deserves to be the cleverest after the trauma of being the youngest child.
You saying that about the water slide, I think my brother used to do that to me.
There you are.
I distinctly remember we were on holiday and there was this massive slide. You had to cross your arms over your chest. Yeah. You know what I mean? Put your hands on your shoulders and cross your arms. And I said to my brother, why do you have to do that? And he said, because so many people die on this, they can put you straight in the coffin.
Yeah, definitely. You were the expendable sibling. You were the expendable sibling.
I haven't thought of that in years. That's so funny. Obviously, we've mentioned baking, but what were you like in your way as a child?
I was quite loud. Mum and dad always remember me just talking constantly. And if I wasn't talking, I was just making noise. There's three brothers, so we would always fight not to be in the middle seat. And whenever I lost, I would just sit in the middle seat, sandwiched in between my brothers, and just make noises all the time. And one of the first things my big brother ever said was, Michael's chatting, because Michael just wouldn't stop chatting. So like I was very talkative and very kind of outgoing and gregarious, I think, as a kid, which is interesting considering now I don't really view myself as that anymore. And I don't really know when that shift, well, I probably do when that shift happened when I was in my teens, but I was very outgoing, very gregarious when I was younger, for sure.
Would you think that people would have thought that you were flamboyant?
Probably.
I don't know, flamboyant is such a loaded word, because basically what I'm saying is, did you seem gay? Which is...
camp, isn't it? It's campness.
I think camp is... But I don't know actually if that's... I don't know, as I've asked that, I'm like, oh, is that an offensive thing to ask?
No, I'm not offended. It always makes me think of flamingos, which is where my mind went, and I had to kind of pull my mind away from flamingos.
No, I mean, did you walk around on one foot?
I used both legs when I was younger, to be clear.
Okay, good to know.
I think I was definitely camp, I think, in terms of my interests. It is interesting, isn't it, that we always kind of associate interests with sexuality, but I was definitely interested in theatre from a very young age. I recently went back to Yorkshire, actually, where I grew up before I was seven, to see that town.
My friend's got a house there that I always think of.
It's you, Michael. It's on a... And I shouldn't give you the address. I nearly gave you the address then. Can you imagine? I walked past the theatre and I suddenly noticed... It's called Upstages. And I noticed where the youth theatre was. And I said to my mum, oh my goodness, I remember this place. And she was like, I think you only went there three times. But theatre has always been a huge part of my life when I was younger. I was always obsessed with that. So I think my interests were perhaps quite camp, and my disinterest in sports perhaps. But I don't think I was particularly effeminate in my behaviour, I wouldn't have said, if there is such a thing. I think I was just always talking and hanging out with the girls, really. Always hung out with the girls. Wasn't really interested in the boys. Actually, that's not true. I wanted the boys to want to hang out with me, but they didn't. So I hung out with the girls. And always older girls as well, which is interesting.
I think that's such an interesting point you make about interests seeming camp or giving them a sexuality.
Right.
Because it's so... It's obviously something that's like come up before on the podcast, but no one's sort of put it quite succinctly... as you, which is just a really interesting thing to think about that sort of the things that we throw on just hobbies.
Right.
Because I often found, because I grew up dancing, and you would find that the boys were either gay or you would think they're going to be gay. Mm. And certainly, like, you know, from one gay to another, you sort of go, I think we're wrestling with a similar beast.
We play gay or nay, don't we, as gays? You kind of walk around going, are you one of us?
Yeah.
Are you not one of us?
Yeah.
And then when you find yourself staring at one of us and they're like a gay couple holding hands, you're staring at them being like, you're one of us. And then you're like, oh no, is this aggressive staring that I'm doing now? Then you try and change your eyes to kind eyes, and then you've been staring at them for too long by the end.
Far too long, yeah. I remember seeing gay people holding hands in public as a teen. And being like, oh my God, oh my God, there's one of me, but no one knows it's me yet. I'm feeling very excited by it.
For sure.
When I was dancing, the boys were either sort of maybe gay or they were real shaggers.
Right. Right, yeah.
They were sort of the opposite, and they were boys that were like, they were probably quite like fit because they were working out, like, you know, dancing, such a cardio thing.
And they can
thing.
Use their hips as well, generally, if they're dancing.
They can use their hips. And so they were like either sort of one or the other, but they had to really push up that sort of macho-ness at school.
I do wonder, yeah, whether there's this, if you're a straight person dancing or in the theatre, you have to sort of think about men, hyper-masculinize yourself. That's not really a word, but I think it makes sense. But it's fascinating, isn't it? Because I think about it now and you can kind of retrospectively put psychology onto it, can't you?
Yes.
You can think, oh, well, it's an escape and it's this and it's freedom to do whatever and you can be someone else or whatever. But when I was like 9 or 10, I don't think I was thinking that. So I am interested in the kind of, I think on one side, it's interesting that we've put sexuality onto interests, but on the other side, is there something in the fact that sexuality does impact you? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, there was, it's sort of chicken and egg, isn't it?
Yeah, and there was an interesting documentary like ages ago, I think even when I was maybe not even out, that Matt Lucas did about gay voice, about lisping. You know how the kind of, there's a gay voice. I think if I say the word gay voice, people will kind of know roughly what I mean.
At drama school, it was referred to as a camp tea.
Perhaps it was. I don't know. Maybe I've never heard camp tea.
I don't think that's an official thing. Mm. Just a drama school teacher said, you know, a camp tea. And it was, you know, not, it wasn't a derogatory way. I'm pretty sure he may have been gay. But yes, there was, there's something about this, some sort of voice affectation.
Yeah, and I can't remember the conclusion of the documentary now. But he went into kind of why are men interested in musical theatre and things like that. It was really interesting. I don't know whether there was a conclusion to it in the end. But I've spoken to lots of gay people. I don't think I had the gay voice in inverted commas when I was younger. Mm. But on Menkind, we spoke to Tom Daly, who was really conscious of his gay voice when he was younger, and he thought it was giving him away. So that's really, it's really interesting, isn't it? It's what this whole podcast is about, I suppose.
No, yeah, but it is really interesting. And it's interesting that we have to consider those things, or, you know, there's a sadness to it if from a sort of young age or from, say, 10 or 11, you're going, okay, conform, fit in, don't do what your natural way is.
What's interesting, when I was 10 or 11, I wasn't thinking, I don't think I knew I was gay for at least a couple of years after that. I wanted to fit in, but didn't, sort of. Like, I wasn't unpopular at school. I had friends, but I wasn't part of the popular groups. Like, there was three or four big social groups, and I didn't really fit into any of them. I had maybe two or three good friends in my year of about maybe 200 or so. So I wasn't unpopular, but I wasn't popular. I just kind of sat in the middle. But I didn't know I was gay, definitely. I just wasn't fitting in. And I don't know when that kind of changed into or morphed into me being gay, or whether that's separate. Maybe that's just separate.
That's the thing, isn't it? Because I sort of wonder that now as I go, oh, I always felt like I really didn't have friends at school. And I look back and sort of go, well, there were certainly times when I had fewer friends, or when I do remember eating lunch by myself a few times. But I also think it was so wrapped up in anxiety. And I'm sort of, and I, you know, now as an adult, you sort of go, oh, was that a queer thing? Was that an anxious person thing? Was it related to neither of those things? And was that just the kind of teenager I was?
Well, I remember I really tried to mask who I was. And I don't mean just in terms of sexuality. I mean, like, I'm a basic pop bitch. I love pop music. I just love it. But at school, I couldn't. Like, that wasn't what boys were listening to. So I was
just not an option.
So I'd be listening to like System of a Down and I nearly said Watership Down then, but that's a different type of listening.
Yeah, that also feels quite camp.
Very camp.
I feel like that might have been a clue. Michael's crying to Watership Down in the corner. Keep saying bunnies.
And I remember really like vividly I became obsessed with Avenue Q, but privately at home.
Yes. That's, if people don't know, it's a really funny musical that it's sort of like characters from Sesame Street saying quite shocking
really
things.
Really rude,
really naughty. It was on in the West End for a bit, but it was huge in America. It's a very American thing.
It's filthy
worth
puppets.
Having a listen to. Filthy Puppets, yeah, worth having a listening to on Spotify if that's your sort of thing. You might enjoy it. Go on, sorry.
No, it's good to point it out. I I was sat at the back of a geography class and we were doing work so we could put our earphones in. And I switched from System of a Down to Avenue Q. And like, it was a song that was quite like operatic. I think it was The More You Rough Someone that they sing in the second part. And the person sitting next to me was like, what is that? Because they could hear it through my earphones because we were using the old ones, you know, the ones with the headphone. Yeah. Remember headphone jacks? R.I.P. Pre-Bluetooth those days. And it was I remember my heart just pounding and being so embarrassed and mortified. And I never listened to music in front of anyone again. Like, I just wouldn't do it. And it's weird because I was really involved in the theatre groups at the school. Like, it wasn't something that was a secret, but I felt like it was wrong. That I wasn't quite fitting that mold. And I think it was probably around the time I was beginning to kind of work out that I might be attracted to boys, not the girls. And that was quite a weird, just a weird, difficult moment.
Mm. And what sort of age would you have been at that point?
I was probably around 13, 14, 15, around that sort of time. So probably in Scotland, that's kind of your first couple of years of secondary school.
Right.
And I remember there was a boy in my class who was popular, funny, bit of a lad, always up for a laugh. And I remember thinking, I remember noticing him and being attracted to him and thinking, oh, all right, okay. But I don't think I thought it was wrong. I just thought it was secret because I didn't know anybody else. Well, actually, that's not true. I hadn't seen it in, I hadn't seen it in public. I hadn't seen it in like on telly or anything like that. It was nowhere. I don't think I'd seen Maxie from Skins yet because that was the first gay person I saw and they were fake and actually a straight person. There was a lesbian in our school who was very out, very happy, very proud of who she was. And it wasn't really a problem. No one, I don't know, I can't speak for her experience, actually. But from what I saw, there wasn't really a problem with it.
Good for her. I always think people that come out of school are so brave.
She's incredible. Shout out to Erin, if she's listening. she's amazing.
Hi, Erin.
Haven't spoken to her in years, but she was fab. But then there was another boy that I knew was gay, but he was a lot more kind of effeminate or camp than I felt like I was. And so I was like, well, I definitely fancy boys, but I don't know whether I don't think I'm gay because I think he's gay. So I couldn't quite work out where to slot that together, really. And there's not really anywhere to explore it, is there?
No. And I think that's an interesting thing where you go, well, I think it's certainly getting better these days.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at something like on last week's episode of Out, it was David Carlyle.
Yes, lovely David.
And lovely David Carlyle. And I think shows like It's a Sin sort of gave us an insight into like different... Unfortunately, it was just men. I wish they had featured some gay women. That would have been lovely.
And bi people.
And bi people, it would have been amazing to... But it's still a brilliant series that I've really, really enjoyed. But I think that gave a much clearer idea of the different types of gay people. There are, you know, the really butch guys. There's the, you know, Ollie's character. There's all these different types of people, different types of gay people, sort of not suggesting that we're all one and the same. But I think... Certainly when I was growing up, I know that you're a little younger than me, but it felt like, well, you're this or you're that. And if you don't feel like this, then what am I?
It built a resistance to camp in me, I think.
Mm.
And actually probably some internalized homophobia against camp. And
yeah,
eventually when I came out around the age of 18, 19, I was my second year of university, I went to pains to tell people that I wasn't that type of gay. Like, that I was like, I'm still me. I'm not going to change. I'm not going to start becoming this camp person. I did that awful thing, which it's not awful thing. I shouldn't shame myself for it, but I came out as bi and then came out as gay in a quick succession thing. And I hope for bi people that changes, because I think the more people see gay people being happy and representation happens more, I think the easier it is to just come out as who you are. I think it is damaging to bi people to have that.
I think so too, yeah.
Endless narrative. I can understand where it comes from because it's kind of like a tentative step in, like toe in the water, but it's definitely damaging. And I think that's why I feel embarrassed by it.
Sort of suggesting that people's existence is somehow a stepping stone for you.
Exactly. I can understand why I did it, because I was kind of nervous about doing things, but I hope that changes, because I think the more we see people being happy, being who they are, it's quite it's a lot easier to come out. Well, I'd like people not to come out, but that's a long way off. Anyway, yeah, I've got myself into a tangent. What was I saying? When I came out, yeah, I wanted people to know that I wasn't going to become a feminine person or be more camp. And it's actually been only the last 4 or 5 years that I've been like, do you know what? If I want to wear nail polish, I will. If I want to be in a screaming gaggle of gays, then I will. Like, it's fine to be embracing that campness. And it's taken me a long time to unlearn that. But I think the roots of it are at school, where I wanted to fit in with the boys and none of the boys were camp. So I shouldn't be camp, basically.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I think it's very common that, you know, gay men not wanting to be seen as camp. And I think there's still a real hostility sometimes towards men that are camp in our community. Mm. And quite similarly to particularly butch women.
Yes, absolutely. It's a similar thing, isn't it? It's two sides of the same coin, isn't it? It's a too feminine man or a too masculine woman.
Yeah, and it's really sad because I wonder if it's because it shows, is it the loudest version of who we are? Is it the most obvious version of who we are? Is it the thing that homophobes expect us to be, or the thing that we're scared that people think it's?
But it's also the opposite of what you brought, not what you brought up. That's putting stuff on your parents, which isn't fair. I mean, brought up in terms of society. But it's the opposite of what society thinks you should be. It's society thinks that a lady wears skirts and has long hair and sits quietly in the corner and doesn't speak unless spoken to and is paid for by her husband. And a man is butch and has big muscles and is the caregiver and all these things. And thankfully, those things are changing. But the attitudes are the last thing, aren't they? The last bit on the needle to fully swing. And we are getting there.
I think so too.
And I'm loving learning more about my campness. And I think it's by surrounding myself more with queer people that I've kind of learned, it's okay to be however you are. Do you know what I mean? I think that's fab.
I think so too. And I think that, historically, often camp has been a bit of a punchline.
Mm-hmm.
And I think luckily we're sort of moving away from that now as well, which is good. And people are... yeah, I guess engaging with all parts of their sexuality or their personality in a way that maybe they couldn't previously.
Mm.
Was being gay something that was talked about at home? Was it something that you were aware of? Did your parents have any queer friends?
I don't remember seeing my parents with any queer friends. It's not to say they don't have any. I don't remember seeing them. It was always okay. I knew it was going to be okay with my parents, which is why the whole shame was fascinating to me. Well, not fascinating. I didn't enjoy it at the time. But looking backwards, no one sits in this going, oh, this is fascinating. I wonder why I hate myself so much. I remember a car ride home. I think it was in my nearing the end of my school time. And mum kind of said, oh, have you got a girlfriend or something? And I said, no. And then there was a pause. And I was like, oh, no. And then she said, have you got a boyfriend? And I was like, no. And then the conversation was over. But my mum and dad, I think, knew from quite a young age. And they made me aware it was a possibility, sort of, that it could happen. But I think I just didn't quite... It felt too abstract, I think, somehow, to be able to kind of engage with as a concept when I was that age. It's weird, isn't it? Because even though your parents are saying, it's fine if you are, they didn't say it in those words, but I knew it was.
Mm.
Even though they were giving me that supportive environment, I still didn't want to be. I spent so long praying that not to be. Like I'd put weird things on myself. I think we spoke about this before at some point, but like, if I could get through this door before it closed, that would mean I wouldn't be gay. Or I would just find ways to try and prove to myself that I wouldn't be and try and force myself to fancy girls. And I just didn't want to be this thing because I didn't, I don't think I knew what the future looked like for it. I really, really hated it. And it took me to some quite dark places, I think, actually. And I feel guilty for going to those dark places because I had so much support around me that I just wasn't using. And I think I knew I had that support around me, but I still wasn't using it. And I still went to those dark places and I don't think I fully unpacked why that happened. I went to uni and I forced myself to be straight. I tried to sleep with women. I tried to have girlfriends. I filled my time with people. It didn't work. It kind of culminated in a phone call to the Samaritans one night where I just didn't know where to go anymore. And I thought that was pretty much it. I thought I was done. The lovely lady on the end of the phone didn't really tell me to do anything, but just sat and listened. And she was the first person I ever told I was gay. It was a very long conversation. It was a hard conversation. Gosh, I feel quite emotional thinking about it. And she said...
Only if you feel okay with sharing.
No, that. Of course.
We can move on.
No. It's. I think it's important. She said, is there anybody that you could tell tomorrow? And I said, yes. And it was my friend Mel, who had gay friends. At that point, I'd met gay people as well. And so I texted my friend Mel that night and I said, I'm going to tell you something tomorrow. But I can't do it now. And Mel, the brilliant friend that she was, just said, okay. And then the lady in the Samaritans hung up, but she promised that she would call back the next day. And so I called my friend Mel and told her, and she went, okay. And that was that. It was amazing to have gone from the darkest place I think I've ever been in my entire life one night, and then the next morning to be like, oh, I'm fine. It was such a massive weight lifted. And the actual coming out process was then, it was like a snowball. It took about a month and then it was over. Susie had not come out since. No, that's not how it, that's not how it works. We all know coming out is a gradual process, but I told Mel and I told my close housemates and I kind of worked my way round. I was really nervous about telling some people, but all the reactions, well, no, that's not true. Most reactions were lovely. I sadly had some really horrible reactions from friends who I'd grown up with, most of whom I don't really talk to anymore because of that. One of them had taken me for a walk the week before that Samaritan's call and asked me outright if I was gay. And I said no. And she said, thank God. And it stuck with me now. And that's over 10 years ago. But yeah, so I don't speak to her anymore. I don't speak to lots of the friends who kind of turned their backs because I became gossip for a while, but I kind of managed to just move on with it. I actually fell into a relationship fairly soon afterwards, which really did help. I mean, the relationship wasn't healthy for various other reasons, and it only lasted a year. Still my one and only boyfriend, though. But it really did help. And actually having a boyfriend was a really easy way for me to come out, because you would just talk about your partner and then use a he pronoun. When I told my little brother, I told him I'm gay, and he was just like, yeah, sure, fine. But the way I told my big brother was by telling him that I had a partner and I used the he pronoun. And I kind of sat braced in my seat and I watched his face kind of go, okay. And then just carried on. And actually, interestingly, my relationship with my brothers has really improved since I came out. I think there was a bit of friction of kind of being like, why aren't we matching in certain ways? And actually, I think coming out was a breathe out for all of us, because it was like, perhaps this is the thing that's been kind of separating us. And so, yeah, everyone's been really lovely. And not everyone, I keep saying everyone, because you always say that, don't you? I don't know, but people ask, I feel like when you're in the public eye, and I'm not massively, but I am a little, when people ask about coming out, you feel this pressure to sort of be like, yeah, it's all fine, don't worry. And there's the It Gets Better project, which is amazing, an amazing project, did amazing work, and it does get better, but it doesn't get better immediately. And like, there are dark sides to it. But for the most part, most people are really accepting, and I don't think I finished my journey of being okay with being gay. Like, for a while when I came out, I was grudgingly gay. Perhaps I would say, like, fine, if I'm going to be gay, I'll be out at least. And then perhaps, I think it's probably in the last 3 or 4 years I've been, people always say you don't choose to be gay, but I think in the last 3 or 4 years I felt like actually I would choose to be gay. If someone gave me the choice, I'd be like, yeah, actually, I'm quite happy in this life now. It's fun.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you for sharing that, Michael. I'm sure that would, you know, potentially really help a lot of our listeners. Because I think that, you know, acknowledging that darkness and acknowledging it doesn't happen, it's not like, done, that was easy.
Yeah.
Now it's, so I can breathe out. I think there is a sort of an exhale, but I don't think that it's necessarily solves all of your problems. And I think sometimes when you expect it to, it can actually end up being quite disappointing.
There's more work to do, isn't there? Once you've come out, you've got to unpack and work out who you actually are, because it's only one part of who you are.
Yeah, exactly. And so what were your thoughts then when you sort of applied for Bake Off? Obviously, you were an excellent baker. But did you think, right, well, this is me potentially being out in a more public way, that my sexuality, not that your sexuality would necessarily be discussed, but, you know, living in, you know, a public forum before we came on the chat, we discussed the fact that I've experienced my first pile-on this week.
Yeah.
You know, being out and queer and happy, I mean, there is still something quite punk about it,
Thank you so much. I'm going to change my...
Is it the first time someone's called you punk?
I'm going to change my Twitter bio now. Michael Chakraverty, punk.
Punk. I'd love that.
Punk, them are pronouns. So the reason I applied to Bake Off, and I've spoken about this a lot, so I won't dwell on it. I have anxiety, I have depression. I have had them, I think, actually since just before I came out or around the time. And I think my anxiety actually comes from growing up gay and overthinking everything, single thing that I did. And I've kind of just learned that that's how my brain needs to work. But I went to therapy in the year before I applied to Bake Off. And the result of that therapy, after uncovering some bits and bobs about myself, was that I kept saying no to things. I kept putting limits on what I thought I could or should do or how I could or should behave. And so I set myself a challenge of saying, let's start saying yes to things. And then I baked along with Bake Off that year and someone said, you should apply for Bake Off. And I was like, no, no. And then as soon as I said no, I was like, no, now I've got to say yes. So I applied for it. So I don't actually really think I thought about being gay really in the process of it. And I didn't kind of realize it was a thing that I was going to be gay on the show until I was announced. Like, and I was quite gay on the show. myself and David were very gay on the show. But when it came out, I got lots of messages being like, oh, it means so much that we've got a gay, as a gay person who's brown and anxious. God, I ticked all the boxes. Gay, brown, mentally unwell. Tick, tick, tick. They felt the representation was amazing. And I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. Oh, some people I hadn't told that I was gay would reach out and be like, oh my God, congratulations, or whatever, which was, I was like, oh wow. And obviously you also got the trolls on the flip side of that who didn't want to see, oh, I don't know what they didn't want to see. Gay people baking? I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing. I just don't believe that you've got the strength in the elbow to really whip up those
gays. If gays have anything, Susie, it's strong elbows.
I still don't really understand it, if I'm honest.
But yeah, like I don't think I realised quite the impact of it until it kind of happened. It just wasn't on my mind really in terms of the show. And like, the show is created by a really diverse mix of people, so it didn't really occur to me. But then the platform that I ended up with after Bake Off was the bit that made me uncomfortable, because I was like, right, I've got these people saying that it means a lot, there's a representation there. And actually Bake Off is a great show because there's lots of representation.
Yes.
Well, mainly of gay men and sometimes a gay woman, if you're lucky.
Sometimes.
Called Jan. That's the only one I can name.
Who's lovely.
Who's gorgeous. Yet to see a trans person, if you're listening, please, please cast a trans person. Or an NB. Wouldn't that be lovely? Imagine Noel and Matt saying they, them pronouns. Oh. Anyway, representation has been great. And so I was like, right, well, what do I do with this platform? Like, I need to do something with it then. And that's where I kind of started shouting about gay rights on Twitter and getting piled on, like it's happening to you today. But I think it's important that we do. And I think people need to see other people standing up for them. And like, if you think about it realistically, gay people really only started to get rights when straight people kind of took on the cause themselves.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I feel about the other letters that so often get ignored. Like, what's so lovely about this podcast is it's not just the G that gets listened to. And I think actually the G has a lot of work to do to help other people, because while yes, we go through horrible things, we have more rights and we're more easily acceptable on television and everywhere than lots of other people, including gay women or the invisible bi people who people just don't see properly, or asexual. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I think there's a lot that we could and should be doing.
I can only imagine that sort of weight of expectation is maybe too strong, but was there an added thing as someone that is a person of colour to feel like being, you know, out? But because there is still a lack of, you know, often if we hear a gay story, it's often a gay men's or a gay woman's, and they're usually white. Mm-hmm. It's obviously fantastic when we get more diversity, but did you feel like there was extra stuff there where you thought, I really want to be visible in that respect?
I think so. I think my surname outs me quite quickly. Lots of brown people reached out and they were like, oh my gosh, there's more of us out there, which is amazing. And I do feel a bit of a pressure there. I don't really talk much about it because I feel I have a complicated relationship with my race, because I wished I wasn't brown for a lot of my life, which is a whole other Out With Susie podcast.
Probably not my podcast to have, that's someone else's podcast, I'd say. I don't want to step in that area. I think that's not my area. But I will happily listen and very happy to learn.
Yeah, I've had a complicated relationship with it. Like, I used to always tick white on forms when I wasn't.
Mm.
And it took me a long time to kind of come to terms with it. And like, I feel weird getting racist comments because I'm like, well, I don't know. Because of that complicated relationship, I get really uncomfortable, obviously getting comfortable, but like I don't know, it makes me feel weird. But I've encountered racism on like dating apps and things like that, and as soon as they find like a surname, they're not interested or whatever. But I haven't really spoken much about that online really, because I don't really know what to say. Like, I kind of feel like racism is bad.
Like, yeah, full stop.
The end. Like, I don't quite know, I don't really know what voice I have to say on that, or what platform I have to say on that. I find it quite hard to know when to talk and when to shut up and listen. And I think because of my weird relationship with my race, I've kind of just sat and listened more than I've kind of spoken up, perhaps, because I don't feel like it's my place. I'd rather listen to much more educated brown people, of which there are plenty, and then I'll just retweet what they say. And I'll go, yeah, yeah, what they said.
Yeah, yeah, what they said. I've loved chatting to you, Michael. I think you're brilliant.
I think you're brilliant. Thank you for having me.
I think you're just a little slice of goodness.
Oh, thank you.
With buttercream in the middle.
Oh, and jam, Swiss probably. Meringue only, please. Swiss meringue buttercream.
I'm so sorry. I don't know how to bake, but you have promised to teach me.
I will
so
teach you brownies one
that's
day.
That's going to be, that'll be probably a YouTube episode, let's be honest.
Oh, let's do that.
People are going to watch that. we can't just have audio of me going, what have I got to do now?
it goes on for so long, Susie, and then there's washing up to do.
Oh, no. Michael, no. I don't think people want that as a podcast. But I know that you've listened to the show, so you'll know what the final question of the podcast is. But if you could sort of reach out, and I guess I'm thinking of that version of you that was listening to Avenue Q and you were scared that would somehow give you away. If you could reach out to that guy or to someone experiencing a similar thing right now, what would you say?
I think it's hard, isn't it? It's hard to think about what would have made it feel better at the time. But I think just to say to that person that any mistakes you think you're making, or any times that you feel like you're under threat of being discovered, like, God, it's weird, isn't it? I've thought about this a lot and I can't think, like, I think it's the, anything you feel like you're doing wrong, it's okay. Like, it's fine. And any mistakes that you make, and you are going to make some mistakes and things that are bad might happen, and all of that is okay. Like, it's going to make you who you are. And like, the cliche is that it gets better, but the mistakes are going to make you better as well. And the bad things are going to make you better as well. And you will come out of it better, and you'll come out of it stronger, and you'll come out of it as you. And I think that's the bottom line, isn't it? Is that all the things you think you're doing wrong and all the things that are happening to you are going to make you who you are. So stick with it. And if you do something wrong, it's okay. I think it's the full stop there. Yeah.
Michael, that was perfect.
Sorry, I feel a bit, I got a bit teary there thinking about that.
No, I think that is perfect. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Suze.
That was the wonderful Michael Chakravarty. I loved that conversation. I'm sure you did too. If you want to get in touch, you always can. The email is hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. And I will speak to you next week. Okay, you take care then. Bye-bye.